From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a look at the U.S. policy in Nicaragua that led to the Iran-Contra scandal. Roy Guttman's new book, Banana Diplomacy, traces the history of the Contras. There was a time when writer Harry Whittington could have single-handedly kept a Book of the Month Club in business. Over his career, he's cranked out over 150 novels, crime stories, romances, westerns. Some of his crime novels are now so admired, they've been published in new editions. Coming up, a talk with the king of the paperbacks. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the British group The Move, and John Leonard reviews a new biography of novelist John Cheever. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Journalist Roy Guttman has just completed a book about U.S. foreign policy in Nicaragua from 1981 to 1987. He concludes that our policymaking process was as inept as it was politicized, as corrupt as it was chaotic, and that it resulted in the biggest scandal of Reagan's administration. Guttman says our foreign policy in Nicaragua had more in common with the foreign policy of the banana republics of the past than of a superpower in the late 20th century. Roy Guttman's new book is titled Banana Diplomacy. He's the national security correspondent for New York Newsday and a former reporter for Reuters, where he worked for 11 years. Guttman returned from his latest trip to Central America Friday night, just in time for him to cover the shooting down of the Iranian airliner by the United States. I asked him if it was disorienting to be suddenly yanked away to cover Iran while he was in the middle of evaluating what he had just seen in Central America.
Well, you get used to it after a while because that's the way the news breaks. You spend months, perhaps, working on an arms control negotiation between the United States and the Soviet Union, and then all of a sudden, just as the Secretary of State is sent to the Middle East or decides he should go to the Middle East, so the reporters covering foreign affairs and national security have to go with him. And you have to relearn or learn, in some cases, the issues from the scratch. Central America is another tangle of such complication that I think it takes every minute of the time you're there to even try to get your bearings, and you hardly get them before the trip is over. And as you say, then you come, in my case, one comes back Friday night from Central America, and by Sunday there's a different kind of crisis.
Were you awakened in the middle of the night?
No, I was taking a nap Sunday and was wakened by my office and asked to come in and try to write about the policy aspects, the policy implications of the shoot down, and to try to think through where we should go from there in terms of our own coverage.
Let's get you back to Central America. You just came back from a trip to Central America, and the U.S. policy in Nicaragua from 1981 to 87 is the subject of your new book, Banana Diplomacy. What was the purpose of your visit to Central America?
Well, I was one of the reporters accompanying the Secretary of State on his trip to the region. He went to each of the Central American countries with the exception of Nicaragua. It was his first trip to the area in about 2 years, maybe the first trip dealing with Central American issues per se, and that's especially the Nicaragua conflict, in about 4 years. What his aim was is still something of a mystery to me. The aim, as his aides described it before he left, was to try to come up with a long-term policy that could be supported by both parties, as opposed to what has happened over the last 7 years, which has been a very partisan policy, and to unite the Central American countries with the United States in this policy. And what does it mean? Well, it comes down to how do you deal with a leftist government, which is right in the center of Central America? Do you try to overthrow them? Do you try to come to terms with them? And frankly, I didn't know on leaving Washington just what his approach was. The sad thing is, coming back, I still don't know exactly what his approach is. But what I did conclude in the course of the 3 days that we were there is that the secretary himself may not understand the complexity of the issues, the fact that one or other factors or partners or people or groups there have the ability to manipulate and to affect U.S. policy in a way that we don't understand and that maybe he doesn't understand until after it happens. And then if you look back, you see, and you have to ask the question, how the devil did we get into that? And that's what my conclusion is from this trip.
What shape are the Contras in the post-Iran-Contra scandal era, and also now that the United States has cut off aid to the Contras?
Well, in military terms, they're in a pretty poor and sad state. There may be only 2,000 or 3,000 in Nicaragua now, compared to perhaps 10 or 12 or even more thousand 6 months ago. They are dependent on, I don't know how those who are deep inside the country get their food, but those who are near the border are reluctant, are having to rely on food shipments and deliveries from the border area with Honduras. There is no fighting going on now, no major fighting going on, but I'm sure there are skirmishes. The ceasefire is more or less holding. Now, that's the military side of things. The political side of things is really in even greater disarray right now. The leadership, the civilian leadership, and these are Nicaraguans of varying political backgrounds, really don't know what to do. They don't know what U.S. policy is. What does the United States intend to do with them? Are we going to give them more money and rev up the war again? Are we going to invite them all to come to Miami? Are we going to just try to keep the movement alive until the next president comes along? And it was in this spirit of spirit of confusion, if I could call it that, that I think they took an action early in June that had a very major effect on U.S. policy.
What action are you referring to?
Well, June 9th in Managua, the civilian leadership of the Contras were meeting with the Sandinistas. They were negotiating over a permanent ceasefire. And unexpectedly, at least to most reporters who were there and most observers, the Contras suddenly announced new demands, and they gave a very sharp, very tight deadline to the Sandinistas. And the Sandinistas rejected it, whereupon the Contras walked out. Now, that meant a breakdown in the negotiations, and it was a very serious breakdown because there was no time set for additional talks. And the impact of that is something we're still feeling. You see, the Central American countries, all of them agreed with Nicaragua on a peace process. And the peace process consists of different things in different countries, but essentially it is the central government has to negotiate with the armed opposition and with the internal opposition, political opposition, in each country to the extent that there is a problem. So when and the Nicaragua problem and battle and war is really the most serious right now, still the major one. So when the Contras walked out of that set of talks, it led almost automatically to a major crisis in Central America. Suddenly, the leaders of Central America started asking the United States, "What are you going to do next? Are you going to simply leave this peace process here?"
So do you think that the Contras intentionally walked out trying to provoke the United States to declare what their policy is going to be toward the Contras?
Well, that, as a matter of fact, is exactly it. I talked to several Contra leaders in Guatemala after they saw Schultz, Secretary of State Schultz, last Thursday night, and they told me that it was a deliberate action in order to provoke a crisis, to precipitate a situation in which the United States had to act. Now, they had different goals in mind. I mean, they would like to get a resumption of military aid, which is something that I think politically is impossible here. They also wanted to get the United States more deeply involved after about a year of sort of a hands-off attitude by the administration, in which it was neither supporting the Contras in the negotiations, nor was it advising them to back out, nor was it helping the Central American countries, nor was it dealing with the Sandinistas. So they wanted to force a decision. And, you know, in a sense, it was a brilliant move because they forced exactly what they wanted. They got Schultz to come down, to travel through the region, to start to denounce the Sandinistas, to start to consider whether to put up another military aid package.
to heat things up again.
Right, but...
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Roy Guttman, and he's national security correspondent for New York Newsday and author of the new book, Banana Diplomacy, The Making of American Policy in Nicaragua, 1981 to 1987. Now, another thing that's happening with the Contras now is that there was an attempt to oust the top commander of the Contras, Colonel Enrique Bermudez. Now, is there a lot of infighting going on in the Contras right now that's jeopardizing their strength?
It's inevitable. When you have an army with a kind of a loose connection to a civilian leadership, and the army has itself been fairly loosely run, it's been task forces reporting to Bermudez over the years and him giving them an awful lot of leeway, it's kind of inevitable when the principal source of support, namely the United States, falls away and itself doesn't have a clear policy on where it wants to go, that you will have infighting, you will have divisions, you will have people wanting to get rid of other people. It's one of those really sad things to witness, and that's what's happening right now.
Now, my understanding is the CIA is backing Bermudez, and Bermudez is one of the first in the cast of leading characters in the story of the creation of the Contras.
He really is. I'm not sure, frankly, how active the CIA is right now. It's just a bit of a mystery to me because they don't have an official role. They don't have any money to spend. I think the only thing they have is the contacts with the individuals, which they can maintain at least on an informal level if they don't have any support. But Bermudez is one of these people who was there from the beginning, and he's there right now as what appears to be the end is coming.
Let's talk about who he is, because he's one of the people who helps start the Contras. He was a colonel in Somoza's National Guard. What was his idea when he wanted to start a group to oust the Sandinistas?
Well, his idea was, I think, if you want to reduce it to the essence, it was power. The Sandinistas had usurped power. They weren't going to run the country well. In all fairness, Bermudez did not come up with the idea of starting the Contras or starting what is now called the Contras. He was approached by a group of National Guard officers who were in Miami or in Central America and who asked him to take over. Now, the reason they asked him to take over is itself an interesting point, mm-hmm. because unlike most of them, including the people who asked him, he had never held a command post in Nicaragua under Somoza. He was at the Nicaraguan embassy in Washington during the Sandinista Revolution. I found a Sandinista comandante, Luis Carrion, and I quote him in the book, as saying that Bermudez was uncorrupted. He was not one of those people with blood on his hands. He was reasonably competent. And Luis Carrion said that he could understand that why Bermudez was chosen. So he came in with his own background was somewhat different from most of the National Guard commanders. Secondly, he's an engineer. He did see some service in the Dominican Republic when there was an international force sent there by the OAS. I think it was in 1965. But he really didn't have much combat experience. He certainly didn't have experience as a guerrilla commander. But, of course, he was not the only one. He was just... But picking him was one key factor. And it is, as you've noted, it is remarkable. He's still there, and he probably still is the key factor.
Now, another person early on in the story was Colonel Gustavo Alvarez Martinez, who was the head of the National Police in Honduras. And I think it was he who proposed to Casey, who was head of the CIA at the time, that the U.S. back anti-Sandinista insurgents in Honduras.
Yes, now Alvarez is an especially interesting character. He's like so many people in the Reagan administration who came to support the Contras. Now, Alvarez is a zealous anti-communist. He's a military commander, I think of probably some skill. He also had, and you might find this ironic to hear, I think that Alvarez was the only person closely involved with the force at any point who really had a strategy. Now, his strategy will sound wacky in terms of U.S. domestic politics, but in terms of military logic, I think it was pretty sound. And the strategy was this, and this is what he proposed to Casey in about April of 81. The strategy was for the Contras, for the United States to back the Contras, to give support and supplies and perhaps training. For Honduras to provide a springboard for the Contras, sanctuary from which they could operate, bases to which they could return. Now, they would form, I don't know if he had an idea of exactly what the numbers would be, but there probably would be a few thousand. And what they would do was to mount raids into Nicaragua and provoke the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas would then respond, and I think he underestimated the Sandinistas, or maybe overestimated them, but he didn't get them right. And he figured that they would maybe even invade Honduras, whereupon the United States would come to the rescue of Honduras, invade, use this as an excuse, invade Nicaragua, throw out the Sandinista government, and, you know, you'd have a new government there.
So the idea initially wasn't to overthrow the Sandinistas, but to, through military actions, provoke the Sandinistas into maybe invading Honduras so that then we could take action against them.
Right. He never thought the Contras could do it on their own. And I don't think any Contra leader did either. Only some people here with fantasies in Washington ever thought that could be the case.
Now, once the United States started actually supporting the Contras, did the people who were in on that policy agree that that was the ultimate strategy?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know how many of them actually knew what Alvarez's intention was. They came to discover it in time because Alvarez became the military commander in Honduras, the head of the armed forces, about early 82, the beginning of 82. So he was in a position to control everything that happened in Honduras with the CIA, for example, and to try to direct things in the direction of his strategy. Whether he explained it to everybody, whether they all understood or not is another question, or whether some of them understood but pretended not to understand was another question, because there came, within a very short time, to be all sorts of disputes between Alvarez and the CIA in how to manage the Contras.
We're talking about the Contras, and my guest is Roy Gutman, who is national security correspondent for New York Newsday, and he's written a book about the history of the Contras and the history of U.S. policy toward Nicaragua. The book is titled Banana Diplomacy. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Roy Gutman is my guest, and we're discussing the Contras and U.S. policy in Nicaragua. His new book is titled Banana Diplomacy. A lot of people assume that the CIA basically started the Contras.
Yeah, and I don't...
What's the story with that?
Well, they played a key role. They certainly, William Casey played a personal role in helping start them up, but I think that is just not the case. I think it is one of these ideas that came in over the transom. That's to say, a number of people had the same idea. Bermudez was called in by his fellow former fellow officers. Alvarez of Honduras went to the United States and offered his strategy for how to use this kind of force. Then you had people on the conservative end of the spectrum, John Carbo, who was working for Senator Helms at the time, and one of his friends from North Carolina who made a real effort to interest the CIA and sort of form a bridge. And this group, together with a man from Washington, the publisher of a Spanish-language newspaper, they went to Argentina and helped convince the Argentines that they should provide the seed money. Now, the seed money was there, and maybe the CIA was sending kind of winks and nods, Casey at least was, or maybe other people. And so you had these various things coalescing around the summer of 1981. And I think what probably made it work was when in August of 81, and this is 4 months before Congress is notified, when Casey sent his deputy for Central America to Honduras to give the go-ahead. Now, so the CIA played an important role, but I don't think you could say that they created this force out of nothing. It was there, and other people were working on it very actively.
Now, before our break, we were talking about how it was one of the initial ideas behind the Contras was to provoke the Sandinistas into making a military blunder that would help give a reason for the United States to overthrow the Sandinistas, basically. Now, the CIA tried something that I think they called perception management. That was a similar idea, really, spreading the idea that the U.S. was planning an invasion of Nicaragua in order to goad the Sandinistas into doing something stupid that could trigger a military move.
You know, it's an interesting, the perception management. If you think of the pattern, here you have Honduran leaders telling the United States basically you should invade. Then you have, and I talked to some of the Sandinista comandantes, and I asked them, did you ever think the United States was really going to invade, or if you did, why did you? And they told me, I think Bayardo Arce was one in particular, that early in 1982, after the Argentine trainers began working with the Contras in Honduras and training them there and also in Argentina, that they had infiltrated I'm not sure just when they came to be known as Contras, but they had infiltrated the former National Guard ranks and it learned from the Argentines that indeed the plan was an invasion of Nicaragua. And they organized, the Sandinistas, realizing this, organized their forces accordingly. They prepared for basically an invasion on the Pacific coast. They expected the Americans to come in one direction, the Hondurans from another direction. You know, they sort of prepared for it. And then in other words, they took it seriously. Now, when Alvarez started making preparations in the course of 1982 and 1983 to carry out his plan. So there was more evidence that this might happen as far as the Sandinistas were concerned. Now, you get to a point in about 1983, where the U.S. Navy was mounting tremendous exercises off of the coasts, both coasts of Nicaragua, and the Army was exercising in Honduras. And, you know, if ever there was a time that the Sandinistas had to fear an invasion coming, it was just all these maneuvers going on that was right at that time. And it was at that time that the Americans hit upon the idea that they really could take advantage of the fears of the Sandinistas. So they basically started putting out the warning in a kind of a veiled way that indeed they might invade. And I remember talking to one of the top Pentagon men, Nestor Sanchez, at the time for an article series we were doing in Newsday, and he said, remember what happened in the Dominican Republic. That could happen again. And, of course, in the Dominican Republic, you had an American force go in and intervene. Now, so I wrote this up, and I didn't know what to make of it. I assumed that he was serious. But, in fact, I learned later that what he told me and what other people told other reporters at the time was... it comes under the heading of perception management. It is deliberate disinformation to make the other side fear something that, in fact, this government had no intention of doing. But you may remember yourself.
I remember a lot hearing about plans for an invasion of Nicaragua. But are you saying that was just perception management, that was just to scare the Nicaraguans into doing something provocative?
I wouldn't say that there was no plan anywhere in the entire U.S. government, contingency plan for how you would invade Nicaragua. But I was told from the level of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they, after all, would have to do the work, that they did not have a plan and that they never really conceived of it. In fact, I was told by the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time that the idea of an invasion of Nicaragua was regarded as so crazy that they couldn't even contemplate it. Now, perception management is really a cheap way. You know, it's really almost cost-free, with the exception of one thing, which is that your credibility suffers. But in terms of military, in terms of treasure, any other criterion, it's a pretty cheap way of creating an impact, and it had an impact.
Now, you offer as an example of the perils of formulating policy in small, secretive, and homogenous groups. You offer the example of the mining of the Nicaraguan harbor. Why do you think that was a turning point in the U.S. backing of the Contras?
Well, as you noted, the title of the book is Banana Diplomacy, and you know, there really is no expression, banana diplomacy. It doesn't really mean anything specifically. And yet, It sums up the idea of a cockamamie, crazy approach to things, where you don't know quite how it's going to come out, but you just sort of do something, and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. It's not exactly what you expect from a superpower, and this is what the mining amounted to. It was an attempt to stop third countries from shipping oil and other products to Nicaragua. And the idea was to essentially drive up the insurance rates by letting these mines go off and so on. Now, what they didn't realize, the planners in the State Department and in the National Security Council, and Ollie North was very, very close to this, was that shipping was going through the Gulf at a normal pace, despite mining by Iran or Iraq, despite all sorts of dangers, and that basically the insurance world had adjusted to the danger of mines. And then the second thing they didn't realize was that the whole nature of this so-called covert operation relied on publicity to succeed. That is to say, publicity which would drive up the insurance rates. And yet the planners, and they came from all over the government, never thought through what happens if the U.S. role is exposed. They had no fallback plan. I mean, this is something that just defies description because, you would hope, covert operations you'd think are not usually necessary, and especially military operations like this. But if they are necessary, you'd hope that the people who do them have the professional competence to think through what happens if it goes wrong. And these guys didn't.
Well, you kind of point out that it was partially because of the blunder of mining the Nicaraguan harbor that Congress ended up cutting off military aid to the Contras, and in turn, people from the administration went securing more secretive ways of funding, which resulted in the Iran-Contra scandal. Looking ahead a little bit, now that four indictments have been handed down in the Iran-Contra scandal, Oliver North, John Poindexter, Richard Secord, and Albert Hakim, can you speculate at all about what's going to happen at their trials, what the outcome will be? Do you have any guesses?
I'm afraid that's beyond my competence because, you can look at some of the things that Ollie North did. I personally think the most egregious things were, in terms of U.S. national interests, leaving aside, the ridiculous idea of selling arms and to try to buy hostages, is what he did within the policy process. He basically acted as the veto. Whenever somebody in the State Department or maybe the Joint Chiefs came up with a plan for containment, for a non-military solution in Nicaragua, Ollie North was in there blocking it because he was the White House's representative at these talks. And, I mean, that is an egregious thing for which nobody has ever been indicted nor punished. There are a lot of specific charges against him. I guess I just wouldn't want to be in the position of making a judgment. Luckily, I think this is a pretty competent court that'll have to do that.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Roy Gutman, and his new book is titled Banana Diplomacy, The Making of American Policy in Nicaragua from 1981 to 1987. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Gutman is the national security correspondent for New York Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Tom Hayden. In 1968, he was a leader of the student revolts and a defendant in the trial of the Chicago Eight. Today, he's a state legislator in California. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Harry Whittington used to be called the king of the paperbacks. In the 50s and 60s, he wrote about a book a month in just about every genre, detective, western, romance. Many of his novels got lost in the crowd, but his crime novels have recently been singled out for praise by literary critics. Coming up, a talk with Harry Whittington. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the British group The Move, their legacy, the Electric Light Orchestra, and a dance called the Brontosaurus. And book critic John Leonard reviews Scott Donaldson's new biography of the late novelist John Cheever. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Attorney General Edwin Meese resigned today after the delivery of a report indicating he will not be facing criminal indictment. Meese said he didn't want to be hounded out of office by false accusations. Now he says he can leave the Justice Department clean. From Sacramento, where Meese held a news conference, Mike Montgomery reports.
Meese made the announcement just hours after independent counsel James McKay closed a 14-month investigation into Meese's activities. Meese told reporters that neither he nor his staff have seen the sealed 800-page report given by McKay today to a three-judge panel in Washington. But Meese said he feels vindicated by the fact that no criminal indictment was forthcoming.
I am gratified by this result, but not surprised. I knew from the beginning of this investigation that my conduct has been, at all times, lawful, and that if the truth were told, there would be no grounds for any criminal action.
Meese denied that there was any connection between the timing of his resignation and the upcoming presidential campaign. For National Public Radio, this is Mike Montgomery in Sacramento.
The White House revealed today that the U.S. sent a message to Iran on Sunday expressing deep regrets for the shooting down of a civilian airliner Airbus, and President Reagan said he feels he has apologized for the incident. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the message, which went out Sunday, said the U.S. expresses deep regret over the tragic loss of life. The statement, said Fitzwater, assured Iran that the U.S. had no intention of targeting a civilian airliner. Fitzwater said the message stated the USS Vincennes had made repeated attempts to contact the aircraft and that those killed were, quote, only the latest innocent victims in a war that should have ended long ago. Fitzwater repeatedly refused to call the message an apology to Iran. However, when the president was asked whether he feels he has apologized for the incident, Mr. Reagan responded yes. And the president said whether the U.S. should make reparations to Iran for the 290 victims of the attack is now being discussed. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Two congressional leaders today called for the U.S. to pay reparations to the families of the people killed in the Airbus disaster. The ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, John Warner, and House Speaker Jim Wright made separate comments urging fellow members of Congress to authorize compensation to the victims' families. At the State Department, spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley said it's too early to talk about reparations. The Pentagon said today the Iranian jetliner shot down on Sunday was transmitting information on two radio channels. Spokesman Dan Howard said the plane was sending signals on one commonly used by commercial airliners, but Howard said the USS Vincennes also picked up signals on a separate channel known as Mode 2, used exclusively in military aircraft. Howard said this played a big part in the decision to shoot down the plane. Ignoring the advice of the Archbishop of Canterbury, leaders of the Church of England today voted in favor of women becoming priests. The synod decision is the first hurdle to putting women in the pulpit in a church legislative process that could take up to 4 years. Archbishop Robert Runcie says he's in favor of women priests, but advised the Church of England leaders before their vote that such a move could cause a serious split in the church. Already, the Church of England has made plans to compensate traditional clergymen who would rather leave the church than work with women priests. South African authorities are shutting off electricity in the black South African township of Soweto, an act designed to punish thousands of rent strikers. For the past 3 years, many Soweto residents have refused to pay their electric bills in a political protest for improved living conditions. But now, the South African government says they've been forced to take action, saying they seek a collective debt from Soweto residents that equals $45 million. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones average closed at 2158.61. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 60s and 70s, the British band The Move went through so many personnel changes it would take a genealogist to keep track of all the bands it spun off. Distant relatives include the Moody Blues and Paul McCartney's old band Wings. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers The Move.
If you've got a young kid, particularly a boy, you know that dinosaurs are really in these days. In rock and roll, though, dinosaurs are all too prevalent, remnants of an era that won't go away. Still, from time to time, you have to look at them and realize that rock and roll dinosaurs have evolved from something that was once young and spry. And for a couple of good reasons, that reminds me of The Move. For one thing, The Move were heavy. The band started in 1966 when five of the top musicians in Birmingham, England, left their high-paying copy bands to form a supergroup. A crafty manager from London saw the commercial potential in this and signed them up. Their first record, Night of Fear, was unabashedly psychedelic, supposedly about a bad acid trip. The song had that trademark heavy bottom that would make The Move famous. Actually, one of their next singles, Flowers in the Rain, got them headlines.
Woke up one morning half asleep with all my blankets in a heap and yellow roses scattered all around. The time was still approaching before I couldn't stand it anymore. So Mary goes upon my eider down. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain.
Their manager sent out a flyer announcing Flowers in the Rain that showed Prime Minister Harold Wilson in bed with his secretary. Wilson sued, and all the royalties from the song went to charity. This was the same manager, incidentally, who figured that if The Who got noticed smashing their instruments, The Move could do them one better, and soon the band was destroying television sets, appliances, and small automobiles on stage. Drummer Bev Bevan later wrote that although the band got cut up, it was a small miracle the fans never did. Between the Flowers in the Rain lawsuit and internal friction in the band, The Move were never able to parlay their British success into an American tour and subsequent chart action. By the time Blackberry Way, their first and only number one record in Britain, was released, two of the founding five members had left, and in 1970, vocalist Carl Wayne left to be replaced by Jeff Lynne. Immediately, two things happened. One, Roy Wood was no longer the only good songwriter in the band, and two, the band announced it was committing suicide, that The Move would evolve into the Electric Light Orchestra. But before that could happen, The Move took off in America. People really started reacting to Wood's fantasies in songs like California Man.
Going to a party, meet me out after school. Well, we go to a place where the job is really cool. And if the band stops playing, there's a jukebox in the hall. Well, with your blue dress on and your folks all gone.
It was really nothing more than a British fan's take on American 50s music, but in 1972 it had an impact. And then there were Jeff Lynne's songs.
I see no man.
actually a hit twice, once for the Move and once for the Electric Light Orchestra. Lynn and Wood stuck to their promise, though, and folded the Move into their grandiose new project, which rapidly became one of the most bloated and pretentious chapters of rock and roll history, a real dinosaur. But I'll always remember the Move with affection for a lot of things, not the least of which is a song about a dance called the Brontosaurus.
Her sister used to hate it, so I never thought she'd make it. But she lived through you all, supposing in a tango rapper.
Hey, you don't think they knew what they were turning into, do you?
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Harry Whittington has been called the king of the paperback pioneers. In the 1950s, when the big innovation in publishing was the cheap paperback, Whittington churned them out in every genre, including crime stories, westerns, and romances. Whittington is still at it, but it's more than volume that makes Whittington special. His crime novels have been rediscovered by French literary critics, who rank him as one of the top second-generation crime novelists. And in the United States, four of his crime novels have been published in new editions by Black Lizard Press, including Forgive Me, Killer and A Moment to Pray. They're both bleak novels about loners with accounts to settle. I asked Harry Whittington about when he started writing fiction.
I came along at the end of the pulps, and about 1948, when they were dying out, a company called Fawcett Gold Medal began to publish original paperbacks, and they published them at 25 cents a copy. They published 250,000 copies of each one. That was just the perfect market for me because I needed the money, and I wrote fast, and they paid fast.
Now, you've written that you agree with Mickey Spillane, who once said that the first page sells the book being read, and the last page sells the book that you're writing.
Yes.
What do you think about when you're writing a first page?
Well, usually I try to bring a character on doing something. I want him to walk on stage, to enter stage right with something driving him, something behind him, something in his past, something that's bothering him, something that he's got to settle.
I think we've got a really good illustration of that. Could you read the first couple of paragraphs of your crime novel, Forgive Me, Killer, which was republished about a year ago?
All right. That Sunday afternoon, when I finally got up to the state penitentiary to see this walker, the prison band was in the middle of a concert. I was tired after the long bus trip and stopped a moment, listening, leaning against the door jamb at the auditorium exit. The music didn't make me feel better or help me understand why I'd given up my Sunday and traveled these 200 miles. People inside were enjoying themselves, though, and I walked on through the corridor, showed the guard my visitor's pass, and told him why I was there. He led me into this crib. It was completely bare except for two chairs, a varnished table, and an electric fan. I saw the fan was bugged, but it didn't interest me. I went in, and he locked the door behind me. I lit a cigarette and sat on the table edge. The door across the room opened, and this prisoner came in. He looked like a scarecrow in prison fatigues. We stood there and looked at each other. At first, I thought there was some mistake. This guy didn't even look like Walker. You, Earl Walker? He smiled and nodded, but his smile had tears behind it. Yes, sir, I've lost some weight. You sure to God have. What's the matter? Don't they treat you right here?
You've really illustrated in those couple of paragraphs what you set out to do, starting something in the middle of the action.
Yes, that's right.
Somebody who's already driven by something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why does that work?
Well, I think the best reason it works is because if you grab a reader's attention and you make him care, then you can do anything. You can quote the Bible if you want to. Once you've got him, you've got him.
You were doing very well with paperbacks for a while, writing in all the different genres and selling very well.
Yeah.
But your fortune really changed for a few years.
Yes. I don't know what happened. Well, I know that I left my original agent, and I went through a bad time. I had trouble selling stories there for a while. But as a matter of fact, during that time, I was writing those books one a month. And I was also writing books or stories as Robert Hart Davis for them. Remember The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Sure do.
Well, that was, they put out a magazine, and each month the main story in it was by Robert Hart Davis. And I was Robert Hart Davis for about 10 or 20 of those.
And after that bad time, I think you gave up writing novels for
a
while.
Yes, I did. I gave it up from 1968 to 1975. I was an editor at the Rural Electrification Administration.
Was that depressing for you?
No, it wasn't. I got a job when I got there that no one in the government has ever had since or before. They were having trouble at these meetings they were having all over the country. They were so dull. The government speakers would come in and they would put people to sleep. And people weren't arriving early for the meetings. And so they decided that they would put on a play, an act each day of the 3 days, to get people there early. So they had me write and direct it, and it made such a hit that for the next 7 years, that's about all I did.
That's great.
It just happened, and nobody else has ever had such a job since or before, but that's what I did.
With the amount of writing that you've done, you've probably spent most of your days sitting over a typewriter.
Yeah.
But you seem to have such a deep understanding of longing, of despair, of a need that will probably always go unfilled. You also understand a lot about violence in your novels. And to illustrate this point, I'm going to ask you to read a passage on page 7 from A Moment to Pray. Oh, I should explain here that our main character has just witnessed a woman take a pole and strike another man across the face with it.
She laid his face open for a full second. He went on laughing and yelling and pawing for her. Blood spurted from his face and temple and all over the front of the counter. He caught at his face with one hand, and the blood surged between his fingers and ran down the back all over his expensive jacket. He began to rock back and forth on his knees when the pain finally hit him. He cried out just once. I had heard that kind of cry once long ago aboard a carrier. A bomb struck and the ship flew out in atoms and splinters and pieces of hell, and the ones that were killed died quietly and the ones that were badly wounded blacked out. But the ones who were mutilated cried out from their guts because they weren't hurt badly enough to die and they were too ripped up to live. That's the way they cried out just once before they crumpled with their arms over their heads as Bullock did now.
When you're writing a scene like the one you just read, are you drawing mostly on your imagination, or are you drawing on memories of things you've actually witnessed?
Well, I'm drawing, I would say, on imagination. I try to take something. I think all of us write from what we are, what we know, what we believe, who we are. I believe that. But I think then we take that and put it in our minds and turn it over and over and try to get the very most out of it.
I have to ask you how you've come up with so many stories during your writing career.
Well, I'll tell you, introduction to my book, I said that it took me 13 years to learn to plot. And then when I learned, it was just like scales just fell from my eyes. I could plot upside down, backwards, forward, and any way at all. I just knew. I learned like a lot of writers never know.
Are you still writing now?
Yes, I am.
What kinds of stories are you writing?
I'm writing the, do you know Mandingo?
Right, that's a plantation novel, a slave
right,
novel?
Yes. Well,
that was made into a movie?
That's right.
Was Phil Mandingo based on that?
They made it into a movie, and the reviewers said that they used to say that of that book, that if they wanted to say a book was bad, they would say it was as bad as Mandingo, and yet Mandingo has never been out of print, not one day since 1956. And this man, Kyle Unstadt, died, and the publishers wanted to continue his books, so they hired me to do the Falconhurst books. So that's what I've been doing since 1975.
Does it pay well to do
that? Yes, it pays. Actually, it pays better than the suspense books used to pay. I think suspense is paying more now, but in my day, suspense was you got a printing or two, and that was it.
Now, look, you're a very good writer. Do you feel like you're wasting your talents writing Mandingo novels?
No, I don't feel I'm wasting my talents writing anything. I tell you why. Because I have had to do the very best I could do on everything I wrote. Everything I wrote, I had to do the best I could do because there wasn't any other way I could sell it. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any friends among publishers or anything like that. I just had to do the best I could.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Harry Whittington spoke to us from station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Four of his crime novels have been reissued by Black Lizard Books. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. And every day at this time, I check in with one of the co-hosts of All Things Considered. Today, it's Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Renee, let's make a confession.
Okay.
Our conversation is pre-recorded. We recorded this knowing that there would come a day when neither you nor Robert could come to the studio to explain what's happening on All Things Considered.
That's right, because things are changing too fast, and we're right in the middle of it while it's happening.
That's right. And because of that, because this is pre-recorded, we can't really tell you what's happening on the news this evening.
No, we can't tell you what's happening on the news tonight, exactly. But I can guarantee that what we will have tonight, what we have every evening, and that's the news, a follow-up, in-depth look at the news and features.
Well, to find out what the news is, stay tuned for All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The writer John Cheever successfully carved a niche for himself in the American literary scene, writing novels and short stories about the emotional and spiritual struggles of life in suburbia. Cheever died in 1982 at the age of 70. Book critic John Leonard has a review of a new biography about the author.
There is the John Cheever in our head, a kind of Chekhov, an anthropologist of the gypsy culture of the American suburbs and exurbs, the poet of our displacement, our sense of a lost past and our feeling that we came from another country and left behind a better self, like unclaimed baggage. This Cheever believes in simplicity and usefulness, the stamina of love, valor, virtue, splendor, kindness, wisdom, beauty, and, quote, the perfumes of life, seawater, the smell of burning hemlock, and the breasts of women. In his stories, men drown and fall off mountains. 15-year-old boys commit suicide. A baby is abandoned on Route 336. A wife shoots her husband as he is about to hurdle the living room couch. A father is devoured by his own dogs. There is lighter fluid instead of vinegar in the green salad and poison in the teriyaki sauce. In the swimming pool, an undertow. In the liquor closet, skeletons. In the snow, wolves. Why is this? Everything is fragile, especially what Cheever speaks of as that sense of sanctuary that is the essence of love. Chance abides, and randomness attacks, and discrepancies devour, and unfairness prevails, and nostalgia is impotent, and evil comes to Shady Hill, or Bullet Park, or Hitching Post Lane. Something transcendent will be required of us, an extravagance, a surprise, a rhapsody, a proof, a miracle. Then there is the John Cheever of Scott Donaldson's workmanlike biography. He grows up in New England, unhappy about his parents and ambivalent about his brother. He's kicked out of prep school and discovered by Malcolm Cowley at the New Republic. He lives in New York City and writes for the New Yorker. He moves upstate and writes for the New Yorker. He wins some prizes and makes some money and goes to Italy and writes some more for the New Yorker. And finally, there's his novel Falconer, which makes him so famous he shows up on the cover of Time. And all the while, he is doing his best to drink himself to death. And all the while, he is also, secretly, bisexual and hating himself for it. This is the secret Cheever, who despaired of borders and boundaries and prisons and trespass, who taught a writing course at Sing Sing. His tormented sexuality was there to discover in bits and pieces and parentheses and codes throughout his fiction, but most of us never looked or refused to see until his daughter Susan's wonderful and wounding memoir, Home Before Dark. What was sad in Susan Cheever's memoir is somehow sordid here in this calendar account. Although Donaldson, a biographer as well of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, means only to be thorough and is always earnest. It's not Donaldson's fault that Cheever's prose outshines his own, nor that we long for the journals that have yet to be published. I should add that I was interviewed for this book myself, and Donaldson quotes me accurately about an awful weekend late in Cheever's life when the drinking was over with, but the sex wasn't. I thought then, and still do, that he was the unhappiest person I'd ever seen. I wish him now his favorite sort of darkness, out of fable, out of myth. It is night, he wrote, where kings in golden suits ride elephants over the mountains.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Cheever, a biography by Scott Donaldson. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I talk with Roger Fisher, master negotiator and the author of Getting to Yes, the best-selling manual for compromise. In his new book, Fisher applies those same principles to personal relationships. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the work of Hungarian pianist Annie Fischer. And Jan Harald Brunvand explores an urban legend, an apocryphal story about a package containing a dead cat. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineers are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.